Chancellor Lord Patton, Lord Rees, Lord Mayor of Oxford, Susanna Pressel, ladies and gentlemen, it's a delight to have so many of you here. A very warm welcome to all of you. I hope and I trust that you will enjoy yourself and also be highly stimulated this evening. I'm Ian Golden, and as the director of the 21st Century School, I can think of no better person to help us think about the challenges of the future than Lord Martin Rees. His book, Our Final Century, inspired James Martin to provide Oxford's largest endowment to create the 21st Century School. His title today, Of the World in 2050, is halfway through the life of the 21st Century School. The aim of the school is to prove that his title of the book, Our Final Century, is wrong. By raising awareness of the dire risks and doing deep research, the aim of the school is not only to contribute to avoiding the catastrophes he identifies, but also to harvest the amazing opportunities of the coming years. We will have succeeded in our work if my successor in 2099 faces the challenge of a name change for the school to the 22nd Century School. Although this seems far off by Oxford and Lord Rees's timescale, it is not. Most of those in the room will, I trust, be around in 2050. While the school is a very new institution by Oxford standards, it is evolving extremely rapidly. There have been many changes since the last public lecture we had here in our termly series. These have included the establishment of new institutes within the school, principally in the areas of climate change, where we have established new institutes focusing on 21st century oceans and oceans chemistry, the forest systems, transport and energy systems. We've also established a new set of institutes on health, creating a stem cell institute, a nanomedicine institute, and a curing cancer with subatomic particles institute, as well as an institute on stopping conflict. These have added greater depth and breadth to the work of the school. The new institutes complement those established a little earlier, working on bioethics, the brain, aging, pandemics, migration, future of humanity, and science and society. With over 100 faculty and 20 university departments doing deep interdisciplinary research, there's plenty going on. And I encourage you all to look at our website to get further information. A key aim of the school is to ensure that this deep research has a resonance beyond academia. This is the fifth in our termly series of distinguished lectures. The last two, by Nobel laureates Sulston and Stiglitz, were on iTunes amongst the most widely watched. And the teetering financial system that Joe Stiglitz talked about in his lecture here was, of course, something that was prescient. I encourage you all to turn your ringtones off on your mobile phones unless you too would like to be on iTunes. The next lecture we will have here will be by Lord Nick Stern on the 7th of May, where he will discuss the challenges required to manage global climate change occurring. We will also have a public event at the Nelson Mandela Lecture Theatre at the Sy Business School on the 6th of March at 5 p.m. That will be the culmination of a day we will have in working sessions with central bankers and scholars and other regulators from the financial system, where we will try and contribute to the management of the major systemic risks we are experiencing. While Martin Rees has identified that humanity is at the crossroads, it was the Chancellor of the University, Lord Patton, who helped move the inspiration of the school to a concrete idea and to what we are today. Like Lord Rees, Lord Patton thinks deeply and cares passionately about the future. Through his roles in politics and now in his writing and involvement in groups like the International Crisis Group, he is addressing pressing concerns. His most recent book, What Next?, covers the broad range of issues the school is covering. While Lord Rees is not only the Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, and President of the Royal Society, as the Astronomer Royal, he has proven himself an expert on dark matter. Lord Patton has demonstrated that he is a master of the dark art of politics, as evidenced by his sublime handling of the negotiations for the handover as Governor of Hong Kong, and his role in Europe as Commissioner for Foreign Affairs. Having mastered the art of negotiations with the Chinese and with the Europeans, we were fortunate that he agreed to take on the challenge of Oxford, which is perhaps even more complex. The 21st Century School has benefited enormously from the Chancellor's deep support and guidance. It is with great pleasure that I ask him to introduce Lord Rees.
Lord Mayor.
Lord Rees, Ian, ladies and gentlemen, I should perhaps say after that very courteous introduction from Ian that shortly after I'd become Chancellor of Oxford, Matt, the cartoonist in the Daily Telegraph, had a cartoon showing two dons talking to one another and one saying, is it true that he's going to give it back to the Chinese after 3 years? It is a privilege and a pleasure to welcome Lord Rees to deliver this prestigious lecture. The James Martin School couldn't hope for a more distinguished lecturer today. When you look up Lord Rees in Who's Who, or these days, I guess more likely, Wikipedia, you get a sight of the public mountain tops of an extraordinary lifetime's trek through the Himalayas of academia. Ian has referred to some of them: cosmologist, astrophysicist, professor, astronomer royal for over a decade, Master of Trinity College, Cambridge. I say that in the presence of the president of the other Trinity College, president of the Royal Society, Knight, member of the House of Lords, more of which later, and member of the Order of Merit. When you look up Lord Rees on the BBC's website, you get less information, but it's much more exciting and even a tad louche. Lord Rees's, the references to Lord Rees on the BBC's website begin with the Book of Revelation. The sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell onto the world. All this is by way of the BBC introducing Lord Rees's book to which Ian referred, published I think in 2003, The Final Century, in which Lord Rees famously gave us about a 50-50 chance of getting through, though he may want to put the point in a rather more sophisticated way than that. Those seem to me, and I read the book with huge interest, rather troubling odds. I read a book which Penguin will be delighted to hear Ian Golden referring to. I read a book myself last year about some of the political, economic, and security challenges that we face. And when I wrote it in 2007, and principally early part of 2008, I sometimes thought that I would be regarded when it came out as like that person at a picnic who tells you that he or she has just heard the distant sound of thunder. But by the time the book came out, the heavens were as black as sackcloth of hair, and the rain was lashing down. So I was accused, rather to my surprise, not of being rather a gloomy fellow, but as being excessively optimistic. Well, 50-50, optimistic, pessimistic, something on which Lord Rees and I join hands, is the certainty that disaster can be avoided if we do something about it ourselves. It's up to all of us to do what we can to ensure our survival, and a particular role, as Ian said, for universities. At least now we have a president in Washington who accepts scientific evidence and scientific inquiry. And there is, by way of analogy, perhaps one more reason for giving us all hope. Lord Rees and I are both members of the House of Lords, the sealed tray of the British Constitution. People have been predicting for over a century now that the House of Lords would disappear into a deep black hole, but it's still there, still struggling along, still ensuring a modest income for some of its members. So maybe if the House of Lords can survive, the rest of us will get through too. Anyway, 2050, some of you I'm sure will be here, though I doubt whether I will be with you. 2050.
Chancellor, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. It's a privilege to be here, hosted by the James Martin School, but it is daunting as well. As Ian Golden has described, the school contains a phalanx of experts who've thought longer and harder about the 21st century than I have. And it's doubly daunting because the Chancellor has, as he said, written a book called What Next? Surviving the 21st Century, and I would like to add my endorsement and recommendation to this excellent book. But Lord Patton has, incidentally, a rather surprising political precursor in this kind of venture. Lord Birkenhead, Tory Lord Chancellor in the 1920s and crony of Churchill. He rather surprisingly wrote in 1930 a book entitled The World in 2030. He'd soaked up the futurology of Wells, Haldane and Bernal. He described human embryos being reared in flasks and such like science fiction. But he was entrenched in the social mindset of his class and his time, especially regarding female emancipation. Let me give a quote. He said, "In 2030, women will still, by their wit and charms, direct the activities of the most able men towards heights which they could never themselves hope to achieve." We didn't have to wait till 2030 for Margaret Thatcher. So that's a salutary warning against predicting social changes. And in science, prediction is hard too, and the most transformational advances, the qualitative leaps, are the least predictable. In fact, Francis Bacon realised this 400 years ago. He noted that gunpowder, silk, and the mariner's compass couldn't have been planned for. And our lives today are moulded by three technologies which gestated in the 1950s, but whose pervasive impact certainly wasn't then foreseen. It was in 1958 that Kilby and Noyce built the first integrated circuit, the precursor of today's ubiquitous silicon chips. This was perhaps the most transformative single invention of the past century. It's led to mobile phones and Google, things that would have seemed magic back then. In the same decade, the 1950s, Watson and Crick discovered the bedrock mechanism of heredity, the famous double helix. This launched the science of molecular biology, opening exciting prospects in genomics and synthetic biology, whose main impact still lies ahead. And as a third technology, space, is closer to my own scientific interests. It's just over 50 years since the launch of Sputnik. This event led President Kennedy to inaugurate the program to land men on the moon. Kennedy's prime motive was, of course, superpower rivalry. Cynics could deride it as a stunt. But it was an extraordinary technical triumph, especially as NASA's total computing power then was far less than in a single mobile phone today. And it had an inspirational aspect too. Distant images of Earth, its delicate biosphere of clouds, land and oceans contrasting with a sterile moonscape where the astronauts left their footprints, have ever since the 1960s been iconic for environmentalists. There was no real follow-on after Apollo. There's no practical or scientific motive adequate to justify the huge expense of NASA-style manned spaceflight, and it's lost its glamour. But unmanned space technology has flourished, given us GPS, global communications, environmental monitoring, and other everyday benefits, as well as a huge scientific yield. But of course, space has a dark side. The initial motivation for rocketry was to provide missiles to carry nuclear weapons. And those weapons were themselves the outcome of a huge enterprise, the Manhattan Project, that was even more intense and focused than the Apollo program. Soon after World War II, some physicists who'd been involved in the Manhattan Project founded a journal called the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, aimed at promoting arms control. The logo on its cover, which many of you probably know, is a clock, the closeness of whose hands to midnight indicates the editorial board's judgment on how precarious the world situation is. It was closest to midnight at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. When the Cold War ended, it was put back to 17 minutes to midnight. The risk of global nuclear annihilation is thankfully still in abeyance, though we can't rule out by 2050 a political realignment leading to new superpowers and a new standoff less well or less luckily handled than the Cuba crisis was. But the clock has been creeping forward again in response to increasing concern about nuclear proliferation and diverse other threats. The nuclear age inaugurated a new era, what some have called the Anthropocene, the first in our planet's entire history when one species, ours, could determine for good or ill the entire Earth's future. Information technology, biomedicine, and advanced manufacturing are enhancing the life chances in the developing and the developed world. But in today's more highly populated and interconnected world, these advances bring in their train new perils. Maybe not of sudden catastrophe, the doomsday clock isn't such a good metaphor, but threats of global deterioration or breakdown that could be as devastating. Some of these I mentioned in my book referred to. And perhaps I should mention that when I published my book, Our Final Century, there was a question mark, which the publishers removed. And when it was in America, it had the title Our Final Hour. Americans like instant gratification and the reverse. Well, high on the list of these 21st century concerns are those about energy supply and energy security, crucial for economic and political stability, and linked, of course, to the grave threat of climate change. I know the next lecture in this series is by Nick Stern, and so I won't spend too much time on it today. But let's recall that the essential scientific basis for climate change should by now be uncontroversial. CO2 was identified as a greenhouse gas by Sir John Tyndall 150 years ago. And it's also uncontroversial that the measured CO2 concentration has been rising for the last 50 years. And also that if we pursue business as usual, the concentration will rise to twice the pre-industrial level by 2050 and three times that level later in the century. Those facts alone should be enough to engender deep concern. The higher CO2's concentration, the greater the warming. And more important still, the greater the chance of triggering something grave and irreversible. Rising sea levels due to the melting of the Greenland ice cap, runaway release of methane in the tundra, and so forth. The IPCC studies still quote substantial uncertainty in just how sensitive the temperature is to the CO2 level and what regions will be affected most. But in my view, it's the high-end tail of the probability distribution that should worry us most, the small probability of a really drastic climatic shift. Global warming involves long time lags. It takes decades for the oceans to adjust to a new equilibrium and centuries for ice sheets to melt completely. So, even though global warming has seemingly already begun, its main downsides lie a century or more in the future. The science of climate change is intricate, but it's a doddle compared to the economics and politics. In his influential report 2 years ago, Nick Stern argued that we should commit substantial resources now to preempt much greater costs in future decades, and that equity to future generations renders a commercial discount rate quite inappropriate. We're mindful of the heritage we owe to centuries past, especially in a place like Oxford, and history will judge us harshly if we discount too heavily what might happen when our grandchildren grow old. Global warming poses a second challenge, apart from the long timescales. The effect is non-localised. The CO2 emissions from this country have no more effect here than they do in Australia, and vice versa. And indeed, the worst effects may be in Africa and Bangladesh, which have contributed least to the emissions. This means that any credible regime whereby the polluter pays has to be broadly international. It's the consensus view that to ensure a better-than-even chance of avoiding a potentially dangerous tipping point, global CO2 emissions must, by 2050, be brought down to half the 1990 level. This is the target espoused by the G8 last year and the target enshrined in the UK's Climate Change Act. That target for annual emissions worldwide corresponds to 2 tons of CO2 per year for each person on the planet. For comparison, the current American figure is about 20, the current European figure is about 10, and the Chinese level is already 4 or 5. So to achieve this target without stifling economic growth in the developing world is a huge challenge. And there's no chance of reaching it, nor of achieving real energy security, in my view, without some drastically new technologies. Efforts to derive a whole raft of techniques for economising on energy, storing it and generating it by low-carbon methods deserve a priority and commitment from governments akin to that accorded to the Manhattan Project or the Apollo moon lander. And we could afford it. The world spends more than $5 trillion per year on energy and its infrastructure. And current R&D in that sector is far less than the scale and urgency demands. Indeed, Tom Friedman, in his latest book, pointed out that US energy utilities spend less on R&D than the US pet food industry does. There's a glaring contrast here with health and medicine, where the worldwide R&D expenditures, both public and private, are disproportionately higher. And in energy, one ought to ramp up to a comparable level to health. Indeed, I can't think of anything that could do more to attract the brightest and best into science than a strongly proclaimed commitment, led by the US and Europe, to provide clean and sustainable energy for the developing and the developed world. The Obama administration may spearhead this as part of the stimulus package, so actually rather little seems to have gone that way, but Europe should surely match the US in R&D and in commitments to infrastructure projects. There are many ideas that should be discussed at a European level. My favourite would be a pan-European DC electricity grid connected to massive solar energy generation plants in the Sahara. That seems to be a long-term future for European electricity. But even optimists about such ideas, about solar energy, about advanced biofuels, about fusion and other renewables, all have to acknowledge that it will be 30 years or more before they can fully take over. Coal, oil and gas seem set to dominate the world's ever-growing energy needs for at least that long. Last year, the Chinese built 100 coal-fired power stations. But if, in consequence of fossil fuel burning, annual emissions keep on rising for the next 30 years, then the cumulative CO2 concentrations will be irrevocably at a threatening level. And we have no chance of meeting the 2050 target. To meet that target, the rising curve of annual emissions must be turned around within 10 years. That's the reason for urgency. And that's why the Copenhagen Conference this December is so crucial. And the lead-up discussions between the US, China, and in other fora. One essential priority of any plan aiming to meet these targets must, in my view, be a coordinated international effort to develop carbon capture and storage, CCS. Carbon from power stations must be captured before it escapes and then piped to some geological formation where it can be stored without leaking out. We don't yet know how feasible this all is. We need a program of demonstration plants. To jumpstart such a program would need up to $10 billion a year of public funding worldwide. But this is a small price to pay for bringing forward, by 5 years or more, the time when CCS might be widely adopted and the graph of CO2 emissions, now rising year by year, turned around. What's the role of nuclear power in all this? This is an issue where expert and lay opinions are still divided. I'm myself in favour of the UK and the US having at least a replacement generation of power stations and of R&D into new kinds of reactors. But the non-proliferation regime is fragile, and before being relaxed about a worldwide programme of nuclear power, one would surely require the kind of fuel bank and leasing arrangement that has been proposed by the IAEA to make sure that really sticks. Developed countries can progress some of the way towards the target cuts by measures that actually save money, energy-efficient buildings, for instance. But globally, there will be costs in meeting the targets, falling on the fast-developing nations, India and China. And these costs somehow have to be reimbursed by the more developed West. These transfers are estimated by Adair Turner and others at 1 or 2% of the GNP for the developing world. Sorry, 2% of the GDP of the developed world. That may seem manageable, but I admit to some worries. We're aware of the underfunding of overseas aid. Almost all countries are below the 0.7% target, despite the clear humanitarian imperative. And this seems to me to perhaps augur rather badly for the implementation within the next decade of measures needed if we are to meet the 2050 carbon emission targets. I hope my pessimism is unfounded. But some pessimists argue that the international community should, as a fallback, contemplate a plan B, being fatalistic about the rise in CO2, but intervening to combat its warming effects, by, for instance, putting reflecting aerosols in the upper atmosphere or even vast sunshades in space. Such geoengineering would not solve climate change. It would at best buy time. Indeed, it's by no means clear that any such scheme is feasible. And the political problems may be overwhelming. Any effective adaptation policy depends on being able to model the Earth's climate reliably enough to anticipate not just the mean temperature rise, but the actual regional impacts and how climatic patterns shift. And you need even more confidence in your computer models before venturing actively to change the climate. And the political challenge might be insuperable of getting agreement. The Royal Society has embarked on a study of geoengineering in the hope of clarifying which options make sense and which do not. Our study may well put a damper on some enthusiasms. It may even reveal that there's no realistic alternative to mitigation efforts. Geoengineering, if it ever worked, would actually change our attitudes to the natural world. The clouds and the colours of the setting sun would feel different if they had become, to some extent, a matter of human choice. Climate change is the prime long-term anthropogenic hazard for life and environment. But there are others. For instance, the erosion of biological diversity caused by rapid changes in land use and by deforestation. There have been 5 great extinctions in the geological past. Human actions are causing a 6th. The extinction rate is 1,000 times higher than normal, and increasing. To quote Bob May, we are destroying the book of life before we have read it. Biodiversity, manifested in forests, coral reefs, marine blue waters, and all Earth's other ecosystems, is a crucial component of human well-being. We're clearly harmed if fish stocks dwindle to extinction. There are plants whose gene pool might be useful to us. And massive destruction of the rainforests would accelerate global warming. But for environmentalists, these instrumental and anthropocentric arguments aren't the only compelling ones. For them, preserving the richness of our biosphere has a value in its own right, over and above what it means to us humans. And that is an important political pressure. Some comments now on population growth. A key subject, because growing populations aggravate all pressures on the Earth's resources. 50 years ago, world population was below 3 billion. It's now 6.7 billion. It's plainly going to be in Asia, not in Europe and the US, that the world's intellectual and physical capital gets increasingly concentrated. The percentage growth rate has slowed, but the world population is projected to rise further from its present 6.7 billion to at least 8 and probably 9 billion by 2050. However, there could thereafter be a turnaround. There are now more than 60 countries where fertility is below replacement level. It's far below in, for instance, India and Singapore. More remarkably, in Iran, the fertility rate has fallen from 6.5 in 1980 to 2.1 today. We all know the social trends that lead to this demographic transition, declining infant mortality, availability of contraceptive advice, women's education, and so forth. And if the transition quickly extended to all countries, then the global population could start to decline after 2050, a development that would, if it were gradual, surely be benign. There is, incidentally, one wild card in all these long-term forecasts, that the average lifespan in advanced countries may be extended drastically by some biomedical breakthrough. I know Professor Bostrom here is studying the implications of that. James Martin's own book on the 21st century, incidentally, envisages a transition to what he calls eco-affluence, a high-tech lifestyle of quality and variety which isn't over-profligate of resources. But he says, and this is surely unarguable, that this lifestyle couldn't be universal unless world population fell well below its present value. If world population continues to rise beyond 2050, one can't be other than gloomy. And the prognosis is especially bleak in Africa, where there could be a billion more people in 2050 than there are today. An interesting fact is that in 1950, Europe had three times the population of Africa. In 2050, Africa will have three times Europe's. That's the measure of the shift. Meeting the UN's millennium goals seems a precondition for achieving in Africa the demographic transition that has occurred elsewhere, lifting Paul Collier's bottom billion out of the poverty trap by providing clean water, primary education, and other basics. Obama's reversal of Bush's policy on US support to family planning initiatives is plainly a positive step. Just as today's population couldn't be fed by yesterday's agriculture, a second green revolution may be needed to feed tomorrow's population, especially as climate change and aggravated water shortages must be contended with. Failure to achieve this would be a calamity of continental proportions. It would also, as Crispin Tickell highlighted many years ago, trigger massive migratory pressures. As a parenthesis, let me just mention one positive development. This is the boost in current medical research on diseases prevalent in Africa. These were hitherto understudied compared to diseases of the rich, like heart diseases and cancer. The initiative of the Gates Foundation in identifying grand challenges to tropical medicine has triggered a welcome rebalancing. But infectious diseases are a growing hazard worldwide. Their spread is aggravated by rapid air travel, but their impact would be maximal in the developing world, where huge concentrations of people live in megacities with fragile infrastructure and services. A global pandemic could kill tens of millions and cost many trillions of dollars. Whether or not an epidemic gets global grip may hinge on the efficiency of worldwide monitoring in its very early stages, on how quickly, for instance, a Vietnamese poultry farmer can diagnose or report any strain sickness. If we apply to the pandemic risk the same prudent analysis whereby we calculate an insurance premium in other contexts, multiplying probability by consequences, we'd surely conclude that measures to alleviate this kind of extreme event need scaling up. It's worth investing a lot more in this and indeed many other low probability, huge consequence events. In everyday life, we have a really confused attitude to risk. We fret about traces of carcinogens in food, about a less than 1 in a million chance of being killed in train crashes, and so forth. But we're in denial about others, pandemics being one, that should loom much larger. This thought leads me to mention vulnerabilities of a different kind, which now may not be serious, but may increase by 2050. These are vulnerabilities stemming from the misuse of powerful technologies, either through error or by design. Biotechnology, for instance, holds huge promise for healthcare, enhanced food production, even for energy, but there is a downside. Here's a prediction from the American National Academy of Sciences. I quote, "Just a few individuals with specialized skills could inexpensively and easily produce a panoply of lethal biological weapons. The deciphering of the human genome sequence and the complete elucidation of numerous pathogen genomes allow science to be misused to create new agents of mass destruction. Not even an organized network would be required, just a fanatic or a weirdo with the mindset of those who now design computer viruses, the mindset of an arsonist. The techniques and expertise for this kind of activity will become accessible to millions. The same is true of cyber attacks, to which our networked and interconnected world will become more vulnerable. And we're kidding ourselves if we think that technical expertise is always allied with balanced rationality. It can sadly be combined with fanaticism, not just the traditional fundamentalism we're so mindful of today, but new age irrationalities. I'm thinking of the Raelians, extreme echo freaks, violent animal rights campaigners, and the like. The global village will have its village idiots. In a future era of vast individual empowerment by bio, cyber, and nanotechnology, where even one malign act will be too many, how can our open society be safeguarded? Will there be pressures to shift the balance between privacy and intrusion? These are stark questions, but I think they're deeply serious ones. We can't, of course, reap the benefits of science without accepting some risk. The best we can do is minimize them. We don't want to put a stop to science. Most surgical procedures, even if now routine, were risky when pioneered. In the early days of steam, many died when poorly designed boilers exploded. Overall, our world is probably now safer. But something has changed. The old risks, though many, were localized. If a boiler explodes, it's horrible, but there's an upper bound to just how horrible. In our ever more interconnected world, there are new risks whose consequences could be so widespread that even a tiny probability is disquieting. We're all precariously dependent on elaborate networks, electricity grids, air traffic control, the internet, just-in-time delivery, and so forth. And it's crucial to optimize the resilience of all such systems. Now, let me look forward in other ways to 2050. We can, with some confidence, predict continuing advance in computer power, in information technology, in techniques for sequencing, interpreting and modifying the genome, all traceable back to the pioneering work in the 1950s, which I mentioned at the start of this lecture. But there could, by 2050, be qualitatively new kinds of change. For instance, one thing that's been unaltered for millennia is human nature and human character. But this century, novel mind-enhancing drugs, genetics and cyber techniques may start to alter human beings themselves. And we should keep our minds open, or at least ajar, to concepts on the fringe of science fiction. Flaky Californian futurologists aren't always wrong. Some of these generally false prophets claim that computers will, by 2050, achieve human capabilities. It's hard to assess the odds, or even quite what that term means, because calculators bought for a few pounds can hugely surpass us at arithmetic. IBM's Deep Blue beat Kasparov, the world chess champion. But not even the most advanced robot can yet recognize and move the pieces on a real chessboard as adeptly as a five-year-old child. There's a long way to go before real robotic intelligence is achieved. But computers have already hugely boosted sciences, especially those like meteorology and astronomy, where you can't do real experiments, but can do experiments in a simulated virtual world. Deep Blue didn't work out its strategy like a human player. It exploited its computational speed to explore millions of alternative responses before deciding an optimum move. Likewise, machines, as well as being useful for simulations in astronomy and meteorology, they may actually make scientific discoveries which have eluded unaided human brains, but by testing out millions of possibilities rather than via a theory or strategy. But they may get there first. And, of course, the programmer will get the acclaim, not the computer. Just as in Olympic equestrian events, the medal goes to the rider, not to the horse. Although we can't predict the future course of science, we can make one firm forecast, which is important for the scientific community. It's this. There will surely be a widening gulf between what science enables us to do and what applications it's prudent or ethical actually to do. There'd be more doors that science could open, but which are best left closed. Opinion polls show that people are generally positive about science's role, but they're concerned that it may run away faster than we can properly cope with it, that discoveries can be applied dangerously or unethically. Indeed, the best-known fictional scientists, Doctors Frankenstein, Moreau, Strangelove, and their successors, exemplify and fuel this concern. More and more key issues have a scientific dimension, whether we're talking about energy, GM technology, mind-enhancing drugs, or whatever. And they have a global dimension as well. So there may be a need for other international bodies, half modelled on the WHO or on the IPCC, to handle these new issues. But however the institutional structures are set up, it's the duty of advisors to government and the duty of scientific academies to ensure that policy decisions are based on the best science, even when that science is still somewhat uncertain and provisional. When President Obama announced his own scientific advisors, a real dream team, incidentally, really great people, he said that their advice should be heeded, I quote, even when it's inconvenient, indeed, especially when it's inconvenient. That is indeed an encouraging statement for a political leader. But policy issues, though they have a scientific dimension, are never solely scientific. Strategic, economic, social, and ethical ramifications enter as well. And here, scientists have no special credentials. Choices on how science is applied shouldn't be made just by scientists. And that's why everyone needs a feel for science and a realistic attitude to risk. Otherwise, public debate won't get beyond tabloid slogans and citizens can't be involved in an informed way in what are going to be very important issues for the coming decades. But I now want to turn to science for its own sake. Francis Bacon, who inspired the founders of the Royal Society, said that there were two reasons for doing science. One was enlightenment, the other was, I quote, the relief of man's estate. I've spoken mainly about the second. Let me say a bit about science and enlightenment. There is a less utilitarian reason why the public needs a field for science, which is because of its enlightening quality, because it's part of our culture. Indeed, science is the only global culture. Protons, proteins, and Pythagoras are the same from China to Peru. Scientists in my own field have in recent decades delineated the chain of events that led from some mysterious beginning 13 billion years ago to the emergence of atoms, stars, galaxies, and planets. And biologists have learned how, on at least one planet, the biosphere emerged, and Darwinian selection led to creatures with brains able to ponder their origin and the wonder and the mystery. It's a cultural deprivation to be unaware of this wonderful and fast-developing story. This year, we're celebrating Darwin's 200th anniversary. It's also the 400th anniversary of Galileo's telescope. And I'd like to mention in my closing minutes a scientific hope, which I have for 2050, which links Darwin and Galileo. It's to discover whether life exists beyond our Earth. Nowhere else in our solar system offers an environment even as clement as the Antarctic or the top of Everest. There's no reason other than exploration to send people elsewhere in our solar system. But suppose we widen our gaze beyond our solar system to other stars. Since the 1990s, we've learned that many stars, probably most, are orbited by retinues of planets, just like the Sun is. The evidence up till now pertains to giant planets, objects the size of Saturn or Jupiter. They're the only ones that have been possible to detect. But an astronomical highlight of this year will be the launch, hopefully next week, of NASA's Kepler spacecraft, which should reveal planets no bigger than the Earth orbiting other stars by detecting the slight dimming of a star when a planet transits in front of it. It'll be a decade or two before we can actually image Earth-like planets, rather than just recording their shadows. It's a task like seeing a firefly next to a searchlight, requiring giant arrays in space or a new generation of telescopes on the ground. But that'll come in the next two decades. But would there be life on any of these Earth-like planets? We know too little about how life started here to venture fermions. But the outcome of the quest for alien life will influence our concept of our place in nature as profoundly as Darwinism has over the 150 years since the publication of Origin of Species. We may have learnt by 2050 whether biological evolution is unique to the pale blue dot in the cosmos that is our home, or whether Darwin's writ runs in the wider universe. It's sometimes wrongly imagined that astronomers must be serenely unconcerned about next year, next week, and tomorrow. I'd like to include with a cosmic perspective which actually strengthens my own concern about the here and now. Ever since Darwin, we've been familiar with the stupendous time spans of the evolutionary past. Indeed, all of us have, except creationists in some places, like the Alaska Governor's Mansion and other benighted areas. But most people, though aware of our evolutionary past, still somehow think that we humans are the culmination of the evolutionary tree. But no astronomer, I think, could believe this. That's because our Sun formed 5.5 billion years ago. It's been there a long time, but it's got 6 billion more before the fuel runs out. And the expanding universe will continue perhaps forever. And as Woody Allen said, eternity is very long, especially towards the end. It won't be humans who witness the sun's demise. It'll be creatures as different from us as we are from a bug. There's as much time for evolution between now and the death of the sun as there has been that's led to our emergence. But even in this concertina timeline, extending millions of centuries in the future, as well as millions of centuries in the past, this one century is special. It's the first in our planet's history where one species, ours, could jeopardize not only itself, but life's immense future potential. Suppose the worst of aliens out there, and that they've been watching our planet for its entire history. What would they have seen? Over nearly all that immense time, 4.5 billion years, Earth's appearance would have changed very gradually. The continents drifted, the ice cover waxed and waned, successive species emerged, evolved and became extinct. But in just a tiny sliver of the Earth's history, the last 1 millionth part, just a few thousand years, the patterns of vegetation altered much faster than before. This signaled the start of agriculture, and the pace of change accelerated as human populations rose and had more impact on the environment. Then there were other changes, even more abrupt. Within 50 years, little more than 1/100 of a millionth of the Earth's age, the CO2 in the atmosphere began to rise anomalously fast. And something else unprecedented happened. Small projectiles launched from the planet's surface escaped the biosphere completely. Some were propelled into orbits around the Earth, some journeyed to the Moon and planets. If they understood astrophysics, the aliens could confidently predict that the biosphere would face doom in a few billion years when the sun flares up and dies. But could they have predicted this unprecedented fever halfway through the Earth's life, these human-induced alterations occupying overall less than 1 millionth of the elapsed time of the Earth and seemingly occurring with runaway speed? If they continued to keep watch, what might these hypothetical aliens witness in the next 100 years? Will a final spasm be followed by silence, or will the planet itself stabilize? And will some of the objects launched from the Earth spawn new oases of life elsewhere? Well, the outcome depends on our generation. Wise choices will require the idealistic and effective efforts of natural scientists, environmentalists, social scientists, and humanists, all guided by the knowledge the 21st century science can offer and the James Martin School can interpret and propagate. Thank you very much.